he developed a hit list of approximately 15 individuals that he targeted for assassination or execution.
The federal government announces a domestic terrorist arrest in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 21st of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a judge puts a hold on billions of dollars of oil and gas leases in the Chukchi Sea.
This is a welcome decision that directs the secretary to assess whether the decision to open the Chukchi Sea for oil and gas leasing is the right one.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Federal officials announced an unusual case this afternoon involving domestic terrorism charges. U.S. Department of Justice attorney Karen Leffler says that both Paul Rockwood Jr. and his wife Nadia Rockwood pleaded guilty to charges of making false statements to Federal Bureau of Investigation agents in a domestic terrorism investigation. The investigation was conducted by the District of Alaska's Joint Terrorism Task Force.
As part of the investigation, the JTTF learned that he developed a hit list of approximately 15 individuals that he targeted for assassination or execution. By early this year, he had formalized that list of individuals, all of whom resided outside the state of Alaska, and began discussing the construction of explosive devices and other means of killing the targeted individuals. He later gave that target list that he had created to his wife, Nadia Rockwood, to pass on to another individual.
Leffler said Rockwood, age 35, converted to Islam around 2001 and soon became an advocate of jihad-promoting cleric Anwar al-Awlaki and began researching targets for execution. Both Rockwoods moved to Alaska in 2006 and lived in King Salmon, although Leffler would not comment on what they did to support themselves there. Leffler said Nadia Rockwood, age 36, was fully aware of her husband's activities. The hit list Leffler refers to did not contain the names of any Alaskans.
You know, what the plea agreement with Ms. Rockwood says is simply that these were names that that she was aware that he got from looking at internet websites. I'm not going to comment on any names. As I said, the biggest concern that the FBI had and the investigators was to make sure the people named were safe.
Nadia Rockwood carried the list to Anchorage to pass on to another individual who was not named by Leffler, citing confidentiality. Leffler said the FBI obtained the list leading to the charges against the Rockwoods. Judge Ralph Beislein accepted the guilty pleas today. Leffler said Paul Rockwood faces an 8-year prison sentence. His wife faces 5 years probation. Due to the plea agreement, Nadia Rockwood, who holds dual citizenship, will be able to go back to England. Sentencing is set for August 23rd. Federal District Judge Beislein today halted activity on offshore oil and gas leases in the Chukchi Sea. Lease sale 193 was conducted in 2008 and garnered $2.7 billion during the sale. Anchorage Judge Ralph Beislein found the Minerals Management Service had violated the National Environmental Policy Act in two areas. Under NEPA regulations, MMS should have determined what potential environmental impact information was missing that was important to their decision-making and whether they could obtain that information. Eric Graffey is an attorney with Earth Justice, the law firm that represented 15 environmental and native organizations in the lease challenge. He says MMS did not comply with those requirements.
So in other words, the agency admitted that there was much it doesn't know and that information rendered analysis of potential environmental effects very difficult to do, but then didn't take the necessary next steps in identifying, well, what information is important and can we get that information?
Graffey said MMS would have to show that the cost or time involved with obtaining the missing information would be exorbitant in order to be released from the requirement. Beislein also found that MMS had failed to analyze the potential impacts from natural gas exploration and development on the leases.
They only looked at the development of oil and not natural gas, but the leases themselves encourage and provide incentives for not only for oil development, but also for natural gas development.
Graffey says no activity can happen on the leases until the agency analyzes what is missing if they can get it, and if not, justify why not to the judge. The major leaseholders are Shell and ConocoPhillips. Others include Statoil, Eni, and Repsol. Shell was the highest bidder on the leases at $2.1 billion. Caroline Cannon is president of the Native Village of Point Hope, a plaintiff in the lawsuit. She says the lease sale happened too quickly, without input from local communities. Her reaction to the decision has been an emotional one.
So there was actually literally tears coming from my eyes. Because it's been a long battle, it's been a long process, but it's all worth, it's worth it. And I'm just so excited. I can say that, you know, I'm very happy. I'm just at awe.
A spokesman for the Minerals Management Service, now the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, says the agency is reviewing the judge's decision and won't have a comment at this time. Curtis Smith is spokesman for Shell Alaska. He says the company is also analyzing the decision. Their exploratory drilling plans in the Chukchi for this summer were put on hold by the Obama administration as a result of BP's Gulf of Mexico oil spill. But Smith says the company was getting ready to begin other work in the Chukchi this summer.
Obviously, as a result of the Gulf of Mexico incident, drilling was not an option for 2010, but we still had planned a very robust baseline science program as well as shallow hazard surveys in both the Chukchi and Beaufort. So still unclear now as a result of today's ruling if we can move forward with those operations.
Smith says the company's plans for exploratory work in 2011 are also up in the air. He doesn't know yet if Shell will appeal the decision. The Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council last week hosted a group of representatives from non-governmental organizations in the mineral and fossil fuel-rich country of Kazakhstan who are trying to form a citizen monitoring group based on the RCAC's model. KCHU's Eric Wander has more.
The connection between the Kazakhstani group and the Prince William Sound RCAC was initially made through UAA Professor Rick Steiner, who has traveled to Russia and other regions a number of times to encourage the formation of citizens groups like the RCAC. Outreach coordinator Linda Robinson of the RCAC said the group of four, who along with their translator visited the Valdez office Wednesday, is in the early stages of forming a citizens' council of their own.
They haven't gotten it organized as far as what their goals will be, what their responsibilities will be, how they'll be organized. So they came to find out how we've done it. I think they're very fascinated, and I just learned that Kazakhstan became a state in the 90s, and before they were able to get really organized, a lot of extraction companies came in and staked their claims, and now they have no control over them.
Oskar Kushkumbayev is the coordinator of the Public Finance Transparency Program with the Soros Foundation in Kazakhstan, which is backing the effort. The foundation established a working group in the oil-rich region of Mangistan in western Kazakhstan about a year ago with the intention of ultimately forming a citizens' council. He said that when Steiner visited the region last year and presented the RCAC model, he made quite an impression.
Our working group was established based on the model of this Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. We decided that this is a good model and that we should use this. That's why now we have 1 year. 1 year has passed, and now here we are here actually to see with our kind of own eyes the real situation.
In Valdez, the group heard from representatives of the Coast Guard, Serves, and Alyeska, in addition to RCAC Executive Director Mark Swanson and others with the council. During one session, Swanson tackled a difficult question from one member of the group, translated here by their interpreter Marina Bell as the $1 million question. This is all very impressive, but...
And this being so good and useful and needed, the question is, why wasn't this experience spread beyond Alaska? Why did the Gulf of Mexico happen? Why were not such councils created in other regions?
This requires a complicated answer. In the wake of the Gulf of Mexico spill, several senators and congressmen and various committees are proposing citizens' oversight for other areas with resource extraction, including the pipeline in Alaska, the North Slope in Alaska, and the Gulf of Mexico.
Swanson said the RCAC represents what he called a natural model.
Resource extraction industries, whether it's uranium mining or coal mining or copper mining or oil or gas, happen all over the world. in the absence of good regulations or in the absence of citizen oversight, often what happens is insufficient, you know, environmental protections get put in place.
Kushkumbayev says his foundation looks at transparency not only in oil and gas, but all of the mining and extraction industries in Kazakhstan, with the exception of the uranium industry. He said the group is now convinced the Prince William Sound RCAC model will work back home.
For a country like Kazakhstan, establishing a working group on transparency is quite a big issue. It's not easy.
After stops in Anchorage and Valdez, the group was scheduled to be in Whittier Thursday before heading home on Friday. Kushkumbayev said they've invited RCAC board president Walter Parker, whom they met in Anchorage the previous day, to speak in Kazakhstan at a conference on citizens' oversight planned for next year. I'm Eric Wander.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Homer's favorite hometown celebrity participates in an elaborate karaoke prank.
I got to be somebody else and have an experience of people reacting to me as someone else, which was really interesting.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
A new poll shows U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller has a tough road ahead to beat incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski in the Republican primary August 24th. The poll found that among likely Republican voters, 62% would choose Murkowski and only 30% Miller. Fewer than 50% of poll respondents even recognized Joe Miller's name, compared to 98% for Murkowski. Ivan Moore Research conducted the poll. Moore says those are difficult numbers to turn around.
It's an uphill battle for Joe Miller to get to the point where he, A, is well-known enough statewide, and B, credible enough. This is the United States Senate he's going for. It's a big ask, and it just doesn't look like he's got what it takes to do it, let alone even get close, really.
Miller has the support of the Tea Party Express. The organization has promised to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on radio and TV ads to boost his name recognition in Alaska. Former Governor Sarah Palin has also endorsed Miller, but Moore says it's not clear how much that will matter. His poll found nearly half had a negative impression of Palin.
And her endorsement wouldn't be any use at all if it was a statewide endorsement with those kind of numbers. But, of course, this is in the Republican primary. And amongst Republican primary voters, her positive is actually in the mid-60s. So it's worth something, but it ain't the kind of endorsement that perhaps it once was. And I don't think is enough to get him anywhere near over the hump.
Moore says his research company paid for the poll. The poll was conducted earlier this month and included 650 registered voters in the state. The Kodiak Island Hostel opened for business earlier this month, offering a relatively inexpensive bed for tourists and temporary workers in the community. But owner Rhonda Maker says she's seeing firsthand the housing crunch as foreign guest workers hired by the island's canneries come to her looking for a place to stay. From KMXT in Kodiak, Jacob Resnick reports.
Hostels traditionally offer a simple place to sleep, usually a bunk, a common area, and somewhere to fix a meal. Hostel owner Rhonda Maker shows the downtown hostel's airy common room.
So I have a crock pot available and, hot water and coffee pot and popcorn popper blender, espresso machine, microwave, coffee grinder. I'm just kind of collecting things as I come across them.
Already the 26-bed hostel is catering to visitors looking for work or just visiting the island for a few days. But since last week, Maker says she's been approached by scores of young cannery workers looking for a place they can afford.
When they get here, they're woefully unprepared for the lack of, you know, housing and infrastructure that awaits them. And it puts them in a very bad position, and it also puts our town in a bad position, because we're then, you know, faced with this problem of, well, these poor people obviously need a place to stay. They need to be warm and dry. They can't be out on the street being, you know, getting sick. And, you know, I mean, you know, it's just inhumane.
21-year-old Kadir Tuna arrived here from Turkey more than a week ago. He says the company that helped him secure his visa said housing in Kodiak would be taken care of.
Our company in Turkey told us they will arrange a bunk house here. So when we arrived to Ocean Valley, they said that they didn't promise for a bunk house or something.
But when he arrived in Kodiak, the reality was different. The cannery told them they'd be responsible for their own room and board.
It's harder to find a place to stay, actually, because there are not much places to rent.
Maker is renting bunks at a discounted monthly rate of $330. A bunk normally goes for $30 a night, which is out of reach for cannery workers that are usually paid about $8 an hour.
It seems that whatever the reason that they're being targeted, you know, to come over here, that's where the problem is. I mean, somebody's making money off these guys.
The hostel's night manager is Timothy Bore. He works with White House Ministries and says many cannery workers aren't being paid enough to survive in Kodiak. That, he says, is taking its toll on the community's food bank and other resources.
I can tell you that the religious community in town is starting to get wise to the situation. The Baptist Mission has the only food bank in town other than Salvation Army, and the food bank is stretched to the limits. You know, we already had a problem with people that couldn't afford to buy their food, with the people that lived here, and then with an influx of 200 more people that are only getting paid $8 an hour and were promised 40 hours a week, and they're only getting maybe 2 or 3 days a week. Anybody that even lives here that makes $8 an hour still has to go to the food bank, because it's just you cannot live on $8 an hour in this town.
Both Kadir and his friend Ibrahim Aralo are university students studying computer science. They feel taken advantage of and plan to leave Kodiak next month. Aralo blames both his employer and the agency in his own country for making false promises to students like him looking to earn money and learn English.
In my opinion, this responsibility should be companies on Turkey. They are sending lots of people here to study, and the company are thinking if he or she didn't, almost another will come.
Now both young men talk of traveling to sunny Miami Beach before returning to Turkey in September. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northrim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. Northrim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC. Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Salmon Lake is the primary spawning ground for red salmon on the Pilgrim River north of Nome. 40 miles north of the Gold Rush City, the lake is critical habitat for red salmon smolt, the place where fish grow for a few years before heading out to sea. The salmon numbers at the time of statehood were so high there was a commercial fishery, but things have changed. The Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation has a project that could bring red salmon back to the Pilgrim River. From KNOM in Nome, Lorelei Kanin has the story.
NSCDC is in the middle of a lake fertilization project. A study done in the 90s by Fish and Game found that Salmon Lake was low in nutrients. There was simply not enough food in Salmon Lake to allow the smolt to grow to adequate size to survive the ocean. NSCDC's chief operating officer, Simon Kinneen, is also a fisheries biologist. He says NSEDC is working toward getting nutrients, particularly nitrogen and phosphate, at adequate levels to produce good-sized fish.
What the fertilizer does is essentially make food for the fish. Fertilizer makes phytoplankton grow. Phytoplankton is basically small plants. Phytoplankton are then eaten by zooplankton. Juvenile red salmon then eat zooplankton.
And zooplankton are simply tiny little insect-like creatures that live in the lake.
Basically, that's what they need to grow big and happy and survive when they head out to the ocean.
NSEDC has the data. Charlie Lean is the director of fisheries research and development and has studied salmon in western Alaska for more than 30 years. He says fertilization took place on Salmon Lake from 1997 to 2001. 40 tons of fertilizer was placed in the lake every year.
By the end of that time period, we were seeing smolts that were humongous. 9 grams, which doesn't mean anything to most people, but 6 grams is considered a normal, healthy red salmon smolt.
And those 9-gram smolt came back. From 2003 to 2007, more than 40,000 red salmon each year made it up the Pilgrim River, easily supporting a subsistence fishery in the Nome area. More than 200 permits were given to area residents, and they were once again able to fill freezers with red salmon. However, this year and last year, there was a crash. The fishery was closed in early July both years. At the time of the closure announcement this year, only 8 red salmon had passed the counting tower on the Pilgrim River.
It is very low and kind of in crisis mode, I would say.
Lean explains that in 2002, there was a shift in policies with Fish and Game.
The idea was to have a more self-sustaining natural system. And so they decided that fertilizer really didn't need to be done. It seemed like this system was recovering and life was good.
And in the abundant years, up to 90,000 red salmon in 2004, the young fish in the lake starved out.
The plankton were overgrazed. They were decimated, and consequently, the little fish didn't have anything to eat.
The fish from those years left the lake at 4 grams, too small to compete in the ocean. Those fish returned, or more like didn't return, last year and this year, resulting in a closed subsistence fishery. Lean says if fertilization doesn't take place, it'll take decades for the numbers to support a subsistence fishery.
It takes about 3 years to prime the lake with plankton and fertilizer to even see a result. And so, in the end, you just don't turn the fertilizer on and expect a big run next year. It'll actually take 6 years from the time the fertilizer kicked on until the adults show a result. And we're about halfway through that.
Lean says the effects from the fertilization that has taken place since 2007 should be seen by the year 2012. He says their target is to have at least 30,000 red salmon return to the Pilgrim River, 10,000 for subsistence needs, 20,000 to spawn and fertilize the lake. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Have you ever been really, really impressed by a karaoke performance? 100 or so people in a small Santa Monica, California karaoke bar felt that way last week when Homer's most famous former resident paid them a surprise visit. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
The idea began when the comedy website funnyordie.com called Jewel up and asked her to take part in an elaborate prank. The idea was pretty simple. Dress superstar Jewel up as a frumpy businesswoman named Karen, complete with glasses and an ill-fitting pantsuit, and send her into the Gaslight Karaoke Lounge with 3 actors posing as co-workers. Although comedy might not be what she's known for, Jewel says she was immediately game.
I like to do skits, and I did one for Jimmy Kimmel about my snaggle tooth. That sort of is an idea I came up with about sort of making fun of my tooth since everybody else makes fun of it for me. And I just like doing it. And Funny or Die is a great site. And so we decided to do a couple little skits together, and this karaoke one was the first one.
Karen, you're coming up next. After her friends belted out a few off-key karaoke standards, they and the crowd began to beg for Karen. Karen made her way reluctantly to the stage as the first few bars of Jewel's 1995 hit, Who Will Save Your Soul, began. And then, Karen's big moment.
Nothing for free. Sound like, who will save your soul?
As the stunned crowd looked on in disbelief, Karen really let loose. In the video, which became an internet sensation when it was released last week, the crowd reaction is priceless. One woman says Karen sounds just like Jewel. Another man says he didn't think Karen was sexy until she started singing. And a third person says Karen is the first person in the bar to ever be asked to perform an encore. But come on, if you were in a karaoke bar, what would you think if someone walked in off the street and hit you with this? This is my heart. Jewel says the makeup experience alone, which involved a big prosthetic nose and an even bigger prosthetic posterior, was unique even for a seasoned performer.
Yeah, I've never had movie prosthetics before, so it was fun for me to get to do it.
She says she was a little nervous, too, that going on stage and performing as Karen was different than playing a show as herself.
You know, it did feel really different. It was, I got to be somebody else and have an experience of people reacting to me as someone else, which was really interesting. And they were so stunned by her, you know, like their mouths were dropping open, and it was a really touching thing to be on stage and have people so genuinely moved.
Jewel's undercover karaoke escapade can be seen in its entirety at www.funnyordie.com. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selvig.
Are you serious right now?
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Eric Wander in Valdez, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Lorelei Kaneen in Nome, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation, and making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.